Actually, you know what? I have a bone to pick with you. It just occurred to me.
Awesome.
I want you to fix a problem you're not going to fix because you shouldn't.
you're really making a good case for yourself there.
I wanted to listen to Under the Radar when I went out for my run earlier today. And if you recall, I run with watch and AirPods only. And I went to run Overcast on my watch, which worked. But the episode wasn't there because you had just released it like 4.5 minutes prior. I want streaming or some sort of manual, please, sir, can I have it updated now button. And you're not going to do it, and you're probably right not to do it, but I want it.
I would love to offer that. I would love if there was a way that I could reliably initiate a transfer that would happen immediately to the watch. There isn't.
No, but it's a cellular watch, man. Go to the internets.
Well, okay. I could do that. It would basically require a significantly different pipeline for that file to get into the watch, for it to be processed and synced. You would be dependent on whatever the bitrate and format of the audio would be, which could be awfully large and complicated for the watch to handle.
Oh, and I wouldn't get smart speed, would I?
You definitely wouldn't get smart speed. The watch is not fast enough to pre-process it, and the API doesn't exist to do it live. It would basically be a really terrible experience. Now, that being said, if there's something you want to listen to that isn't already on your watch and you want to sync it over immediately and watchOS just isn't syncing it, that's also a terrible experience. But fixing, like, that's the kind of thing that I assume, and maybe after this many years, this is, might be a bad assumption, but I assume that that's the kind of thing that Apple's likely to fix sometime. Whereas the complexity of having these two different ways for a file to get on the watch, and you know, and have to having to sync things between them, having to manage the different experiences that you get between them, that, like, complexity is forever. Shortcomings are usually temporary. So I decided to just kind of wait and see. Like, right now, the auto syncing in the background is good enough for most people most of the time,
including me, for the record.
Right, and so, like, it's mostly fine. And so I'd rather not rapidly increase the complexity in order to improve that a little bit, especially since most people don't have cellular watches. And even those who do, oftentimes it isn't activated because cellular Apple Watches generally are very disappointing. And the cellular service is not good and very unreliable. So, also, I'd be concerned about Apple rejecting the app for using the cellular data too aggressively if it happened during their testing, and that maybe they downloaded a large file and then they would reject the app for using too much cell data. So there's all sorts of risks and problems with doing that, not to mention the fact that working on watchOS is incredibly painful. And so the process of developing all of this complexity, like, this kind of stuff would be simpler to do on iOS. Like, it wouldn't take as much effort on iOS. But everything on watchOS is like moving through maple syrup. And it's maple syrup that occasionally catches fire and burns you as you're in it. Like, it's just
delightful.
It's terrible. Like, working in watchOS is terrible. It's time consuming and morale sucking and just terrible. So I'd like to do as little of it as possible.
It's understandable. I don't know. I don't know what the UI would look like for this, which is why I'm going to let it go, because I know you should not make this feature. But I really wish there was some way to be like, hey, I know that there is a specific podcast and I want to listen to it right frickin' now. I'm willing to trade off the lack of smart speed and, you know, the bitrate issues you were discussing. I don't care. I want it now. It's my podcast and I need it now.
Just run back to your house and grab your phone.
Yeah. I mean, because here's the other problem with this is, suppose I did all that work. This feature is still used by very few people. Like, yeah, actual, like, offline playback, like playback on standalone watch without the phone. Every time you hit play on that, I record, like, you know, a user has done this. And it's a part of my analytics that I report only to me, so don't worry. But, like, I can track, like, what percentage of the active user base uses feature X. And the percentage of people who use that is minuscule. And it's really unfortunate because it took me a lot of time and work and morale sucking maple syrup fires. It was it took so much out of me to do that feature, and almost no one uses it. And part of it, like, I'm not mad at the public for not using it. It isn't that good. It's fine. I got it to a point where it's usable after like 3 years, but it's not great. Using your phone is better. And the only reason to not have your phone usually is if you're running. But runners usually want to listen to music and not podcasts. So it's a very small percentage of people, I think, who really use this feature. And so it's not worth massive investment. And you could say maybe more people would use it if it was better. And that's probably true. But how many more? Five times as many? Probably not. Is it maybe 50% more? Maybe. Probably not even that. So I think it would still be a very, very low percentage. By the way, even if five times as many people use it, that would still be embarrassingly low.
Yeah, that's fair. There are dozens of us, Marco. Dozens.
There are literally dozens of you, I think. Like, I really don't think the number is that much
bigger. Is that something you could pull up easily, or is that the sort of thing
yes,
where you
is.
Need?
Hold on.
I mean, even a broad order of magnitude, I would be very curious to hear exactly how minuscule it is.
Most days, it's about 0.25% of active users.
My word.
Now, to give you some idea, that is about half as much usage as the web player gets from logged in users. And no one uses the web player. It's near the widget. No one uses the widget. Now, to give you some idea, about 30% of users have an Apple Watch paired to their phone. And 0.25% use this feature.
Aye. So, not to put a terrible idea in your head, but why is it still there then?
It's the kind of feature that people think they'll use. I thought people would use it when I was making it. And so it's the kind of feature that you might make a competitive decision of which podcast app to use based on whether this feature exists, even if you don't end up using it in practice. So I think it is important to offer it, but if I was like starting over from scratch, if I couldn't use any of my old code, if I had to rewrite my entire app from scratch, knowing what I know now, I wouldn't re-implement this feature. But because it's already there and because it serves a decent role in competitive, you know, customer acquisition, then I'll keep it there. But it certainly is not worth the effort it took to build.
Yeah, that's fair. And that bums me out. But I mean, the numbers tell you what the reality is. It's funny too, because when I was still a person with a job, there was a Oakland office that opened for about a year. And so we were an East Coast company. Then this Oakland office comes in, and the like product owner and project managers from Oakland, like all they wanted to do was A/B test everything. The numbers will tell us all the answers. And I always found that very disheartening and disappointing, because I felt like it was just punting on making difficult decisions. Oh, well, we'll just trust the users. The users will definitely know what they want. And that always seemed like a poor choice to me. However, even I can agree that there are some numbers that are indisputable. 0.25%. That's some pretty big evidence that you should probably leave this crap alone or not worry too much about it.
Right. To give you some idea, Siri intents, which like Siri kit usage, which I would think would be a very narrow feature, 5%. Way, way higher.
Speaking of that, I've been talking to my AirPods while playing Overcast, and the conversation has not been going well.
Okay.
I can ask my new fancy AirPods to start playing or to stop playing, which is convenient when my hands are all messy in the kitchen. And I can also ask for volume adjustments, and those happen. But anytime I want anything else to happen, I have a very one-sided conversation with Siri that always culminates in whatever audio was playing stopping, and then me waiting a certain amount of time to see if whatever I asked for is going to happen, and then me giving up and then saying, hey, dingus, play. And it picks up right where I left off. Usually what I want to do is skip forward a certain amount of time, skip back a certain amount of time, go to the next track, go to the previous track. Every time I say, hey, dingus, to my AirPods and issue one of those commands in any way I can possibly think of it, audio stops, and that's the end. And then I just say, hey, dingus, play, and it picks up right where the audio stopped previously. What can I say to my AirPods that Overcast will understand?
I don't know. I should probably get AirPod 2s and see, but I mean, I assume I can do the same thing with Siri on the phone.
Skip forward 30 seconds, skip back 30 seconds, next track, previous track, skip to next track, go to next track, go to previous track. Like, I've tried every variation I could possibly think of, and and it's, and I've tried pauses between "Hey Dingus" and issuing the command.
That shouldn't matter.
And no pause, and I don't honestly know what it's doing. It obviously hears me say "Hey Dingus" because it stops playing the audio, and it still hears me when I give up and say "Hey Dingus, play," and it starts playing it again. But
so I mean, first of all, like the Siri implementation in iOS 12 that I have right now, Siri does some weird things with audio. So for instance, iOS has the concept of, you know, there's an audio session that your app has, which is like how your app audio interacts with the system audio and how it's managed with things like whether things are allowed to play at the same time as your app audio, whether things should duck your app's audio. And there's concepts with things like the active app, things like whether your audio session is active and whether it's currently being interrupted. So for instance, if you're playing a podcast and you get a phone call, your audio session gets automatically interrupted and paused. And then when the phone call ends, you get the interruption ended message and you can resume your audio. Well, one of the things that also pauses your app's audio is Siri. When you've held in the Siri button and Siri, you know, goes boop boop and it kicks on and starts listening, if you're playing anything, your session gets interrupted. And then it resumes afterwards. Also, if Siri has to respond to you, that maintains the interruption or starts one if it isn't already interrupted. Now, if you ask Siri to do something in Overcast, right now Siri does not, the iOS 12 Siri kit intents have only a very rudimentary idea of whether you're doing anything audio related. They seem to have no bearing. They seem to not really change their behavior at all if you're using the play media intent. So when you get one of the things I had to work around last summer when I was implementing this is that if you send basically the Siri command for Overcast to start playing, Siri will respond in audio like, okay, done, or, you know, whatever it says. And that will interrupt the playback it just started by telling me to play.
Nice.
Yeah, right? Is it great? So there's also, and because these things all happen kind of at the same time or like in the same run loop iteration sometimes, like because things are happening very quickly all at the same time, sometimes it gets things wrong and deactivates your audio session permanently or creates an interruption that it never ends. So you're just permanently interrupted and you never resume. So, and I've talked to people who make other podcast apps about this. We've all had to do things like add delays before we actually start playing to give Siri a chance to end its audio interruption that it's using to respond to you with before we start playing. And like anytime you introduce an intentional delay into your app, like you're just asking for bugs at that point. Like that's a huge code smell. Like you never want to have like, you know, dispatch after 0.25 seconds just to avoid some bug. Like that's never a good thing to have to do. But everyone I've known who's written a podcast app with Siri kit support has had to do things like that, like put in a small delay before we actually start playback. Otherwise, Siri will kill it in a way that we can't undo. So there's all sorts of weird issues with the way Siri handles audio interruptions and the way it responds to commands with Siri kit that make it very hard to make a lot of these things reliable. So it's possible that some of these things might just be like the exact timing Siri is having for you with a certain combination of commands and hardware and whatever might be wrong or might be hitting a bug with Siri kit. And it's really hard to diagnose those things.
It's weird that asking it to play always works. Like I assume whatever like the media controls that are, you know, just presented like in Control Center has the play button and it has the next and previous track button. I'm basically trying to find the voice equivalent of I know iOS, you probably don't know much about the application that's playing audio, but one is playing audio and you offer those three controls and they all work in Control Center. So just virtually tap one of those buttons for me now, but I can't get it to do what I want.
Two other things. Number one, AirPods specifically, there's a lot of special case audio handling in the OS for AirPods. Whatever they do, and I haven't played with the second ones yet, but the first gen AirPods do a lot of crazy stuff with like Bluetooth recompression or transcoding or something. There's all sorts of weird Overcast bugs that I've hit that only happen with AirPods, and sometimes like weird system behaviors and things like that that basically only happen when you have AirPods connected and with no other Bluetooth headphones. So there's something there, like however they handle the AirPods at the system level, there's some kind of special casing that breaks things sometimes. And then secondly, you have an issue where if you whatever phrase you use to do Overcast Siri shortcuts, it's very hard to come up with phrases that the system that Siri will not try to be smart about and like take back the meaning of the shortcut to mean its own thing. So for instance, if you have a play shortcut for Overcast and you call it play in Overcast, that is very unlikely to work reliably, because Siri sees play Overcast or whatever play, and it'll start looking for an artist in Apple Music named Overcast. Like, it tries to be smart when it sees phrasing that it thinks it recognizes. And that's why, with all my example phrases in the SiriKit dialogue, I prefix them all with Overcast. So I suggest you use phrasing like Overcast play. And the reason I do that is because when you begin the command with Overcast, then you can use like a phrase that Siri would normally pick up as a media phrase, and it seems not to do it. It seems to be able to keep those things separate if the first word is Overcast. But it's so complicated. It's hard to make a lot of it reliable.
All right, I'll try addressing the application. I mean, I figured just because it was the current audio session that I was trying to essentially do the verbal equivalent of just like basic commands available on any playing audio stream, but I'll try issuing application commands.
I mean, that should work. In theory, that should even work better, because if you issue a command that it interprets the same way it would have interpreted you tapping the buttons in Control Center, that's a whole different mechanism of how it sends that command to the app that is way more reliable.
But I don't know what to say to make that happen. Like, every combination of words I've tried has resulted in dead silence from the AirPods.
I mean, normally you should be able to say things like skip forward 30 seconds. Like, that should work just fine.
I cannot. It does not. Casey, you should try that when you get a chance, because you've got the new. I don't know if it's different on the new or the old ones. Yeah, the voice activation is the only difference. I never used Hey Dingus on the tapping. The taps were always for play pause on my AirPod 1s. On the AirPod 2s, like, I just get the Hey Dingus for free, so I've been trying to use it and doesn't want to listen to me.
I do find that normally if I say, hey, Dingus, you know, turn off my cable lamp or something like that, it does take annoyingly long to come back to playing, but it does usually start playing again. And typically if I'm listening to something, it would be Overcast. Overcast on the phone, you know, the AirPods are paired to the phone, and I say, hey, Dingus, you know, turn off my cable lamp. Wait. Okay. Wait. Oh, okay, and there's my podcast again. But I will say that there are definitely times that I have done the Hey Dingus dance and nothing has happened afterwards. Like, it will typically do whatever request I've asked for, but then it will never restart audio again.
Yeah, my audio never restarts when I issue one of those commands. It just goes silent, and it still knows the playback position because I go, hey, Dingus, play, and it starts playing right where it left off.
So if you say, like, skip forward 30 seconds, It not only does it not skip forward 30 seconds, but it also doesn't resume playback?
Nope.
That's really weird. Yeah, I mean, it is. It sounds like the way you're describing this, and Casey, you too, like the way you're describing, like, it takes a long time to resume, that sounds like just bad interruption handling by Siri. But I don't, and that's, unfortunately, that's probably out of any app's control. But it's so hard to work with this stuff.
Yeah.
The other problem, like, I frequently have problems with Siri that I can't use Hey Dingus when I'm playing a podcast out loud, because, or any Siri rather, like when I hit the button to start Siri, or if I say Hey Dingus, but even if I hit the hardware button on the side of the phone, it will pick up. It'll pause the podcast, but it will insert as my query the last few words that were spoken in the podcast.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I keep meaning to bring this up on the show. If you cut all the rest of the crap we've been talking about, that's fine. But you got to leave this in, because this has been driving me insane. That is exactly the behavior I've seen. So a lot of times I'll mash down on whatever the technical term is for the right side button on the phone, the sleep-wake button or whatever it is. I'll mash down on it. And just like you said, the podcast pauses pretty darn quick and before it appears that Siri is ready to listen. But the first 3 to 5 words of my request to the Dingus are the last 3 to 5 words I've heard on the podcast. And yep, it is driving me insane. Like, I understand what they're doing and it does make sense, but oh my word, it is so frustrating.
Yeah. And I have no idea how to fix that. I mean, as far as I know, like, cause I can't, when the audio interruption happens, you don't get notified in advance and you have no control over it. It interrupts your session and it just says, hey, you're interrupted now. Here's why. And it cuts off your audio, like, at whatever time it wants to, and that's it. You lose complete control at that point. So I can't, like, cut off the audio at a different time. I'm not cutting it off late. Like, it's totally out of my control. So that's just iOS being iOS.
Yeah, the OS should be able to do this because the OS knows what sound it's putting out through the audio system. And if the sound that it was putting out is suspiciously similar to the sound that it was, I understand like the preload buffer, like you want to start listening before, you know, have a little bit of the buffer of the thing that's always listening. Like it makes sense, but it should know. I just put out that audio around about the same time I was hearing it. So filter that out, kind of like echo cancellation and all sorts of other things. You know, yeah. That would help it not be triggered by itself. It probably wouldn't help with ambient noise. Like if you're playing the podcast on another speaker, there's only so much you can do.
No, but like, but the device itself tricks itself via its own speaker, yeah. which
yeah.
is
yeah, the internal yeah. speaker. Yeah, or maybe you mean if it was super clever, it could maybe even do it if it was air playing. Obviously, if the audio is from an entirely different source, what can you do? But it's coming from the phone in any fashion. It would be nice. That's another feature they can add to iOS 13.
We should probably actually start the show and do a little bit of follow-up. And Anonymous writes, yes, AirPower was always going to be a, quote, place the device anywhere, quote, product, with multiple overlapping coils. Early in the concept phase, it was going to be a much larger mat with a squared-off footprint and something like three times as many coils. But that was scrapped pretty quickly because using that much copper would have meant an astronomical retail price. Power by Proxy had zero involvement with the version of AirPower shown off on stage in the 2017 iPhone event.
So in our continued air power news, I love that we're still talking about this. I love that we're still getting updates about this. I wonder, when do you think is the last time that we will get like tip info about air power? Do you think it's like, do you think it has already happened where it's basically now? Or do you think it's like a week out, a month out, a year out? How long do you think the air power tipster train will go?
I think this is probably the end of it because we have like we start off with the one story and this is a refuting everything about that story. So I feel like they both bounce each other out and it'll be a long time before the actual truth, like you said, is revealed because someone involved in the project writes about it in their memoirs or something.
I'm looking forward to that time though.
I'm not. I just couldn't possibly care less.
I don't know. I think it'll be fascinating seeing or hearing about what happened. Although, to be honest, the reality situation is it's probably like every other botched corporate product. Oh, hey, there's this great idea. Let's try it. Oh, it didn't work. Okay, let's kill it. Okay, good talk.
Yeah, probably.
That's all right. All right, iFred writes, the Netflix AirPlay thing is likely driven by a royalty fee where second screens and primary screens have different rights. This isn't something that's going to be shared publicly because it just stirs stuff up. I'm a video engineer in this field. From player data and manifests being served, it still looks like you're just playing a profile for iOS. I think that Fred's point here is that you can't really tell what screen you're beaming to if you're on the physical device screen or if you're AirPlaying when you're the Netflix app. It still looks like a nice protected video playpen, and you can say that it's still a second screen experience. Big corporation cable killed Chromecast support for a similar reason.
It's so weird to think of like when they say second screen, what they mean is like the primary screen of the device the Netflix app is on. But it's a second screen because it's not a television, right? The lingo is so television centric. Television is the first screen. Any other screen is the second screen. Even if the Netflix app itself is running on the phone, the phone's screen is a second screen.
Moving on, Mark Plus writes, there's no quality loss when beaming full-screen videos via AirPlay. The raw MP4 data is sent directly. Recompression only happens when using AirPlay screen mirroring and no full-screen video is playing. Is that true for AirPlay 1 as well? Because that was not my understanding, but I could be wrong.
I mean, I suppose it depends on what you're AirPlaying 2. Maybe there's something in the specs. Obviously, it can't send the raw data stream if the raw data stream is in a codec or even in just a profile that the receiving device can't decode. So there would have to be recompression, but presumably that doesn't happen with the Netflix app. Presumably it intentionally makes sure that it sends data that can go straight through to any existing AirPlay device without recompression.
Finally, John, tell us about your fidget spinner.
We're talking about the terrible clicking noise that some people's new AirPod cases make. I've heard from a few people who say their case doesn't make that sound, but I've heard from many more that it does. Anyway, I said they should have turned the case into a fidget spinner because it's kind of good for that. Lo and behold, someone actually has a product that turns your AirPod case into a fidget spinner. It's sort of like a sleeve that your AirPod case goes into with a little thing on the front and back for you to put your fingers on, a little ball bearings in it. So you just sort of pinch the case between your fingers and spin it. And there you go. AirPods as fidget spinner.
As the gods intended.
This is a real product. It's $25 that you can buy right now.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host. You can instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. Get a server running in seconds with your choice of Linux distro, resources, and 10 node locations. And Linode is proud to announce their newest data center in Toronto, Canada. Built using their most up-to-date hardware and their next-generation network backbone, Linode Toronto allows users to comply with in-country data protection requirements and take advantage of all of Linode's technology and tools while they do it. Linode is fantastic. I love hosting at Linode. I host all of my servers there for Overcast and Marco.org, and it's wonderful because you can build whatever you want there. They have dedicated CPUs. They have distributed application capabilities. You can host services, websites, continuous integration, continuous deployment types of environments, and so much more. Linode has native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors, all available from their 10 worldwide data centers, including they're adding one in Mumbai, India, by the end of 2019. All of their plans are amazingly well-priced. This is one of the reasons I like them so much. They're an incredible value, and I've been with them for something like 8 years, and they've always been. Like, it isn't like they have one good sale, and then they're a bad value the next 3 years. That's never happened. They've been a great value the entire time I've been a customer, long before they were a sponsor of our show. This is why I'm there. It's a great value, backed by great hardware, incredibly good performance, and a really nice control panel, too. So it's all very easy to use, very easy to afford. They have hourly billing up to monthly caps. They have a 7-day money-back guarantee, a new cloud manager featuring an even better user interface. It's wonderful. Also, they're hiring. If you might want to work for them, go to linode.com/careers. Anyway, when you sign up, use promo code ATP2019, and that can get you a $20 credit. And their base plan starts at just $5 a month, so that could be 4 months free. So once again, linode.com/ATP and code ATP2019 for a $20 credit. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all of my servers and sponsoring our show.
I would like to take a moment. I don't have a good link in the show notes as I sit here right now, but perhaps we can find one. I'd like to take a moment to comment on the recent goings-on with the photo of the black hole and the lead architect. I don't think that's the title, the correct title, but I'm, for lack of a better one, lead architect behind this, who was a woman named Katie Bowman. And shortly after this momentous astrological thing, this momentous moment in astronomy happened, it seems like all the idiot boys had to come out of the woodwork to try to stir things up. And I don't know that we need to go into it that much, but I find it extraordinarily disappointing and gross and tacky and unnecessary and disgusting that a bunch of very insecure boys decided to go trolling through various GitHub repos to try to prove that Katie Bowman was taking credit for other people, particularly men's work. And as far as I understand, some of the co-authors of the code and the different papers that this work was based on, many of whom were men, have come out to say, no, this is her work. Like, this is really her. And I just wanted to publicly say that I think this is bullshit, and it really makes me sad.
I admit I have not been following this incredibly closely. I just know the high level overview that I think Everyone knows at this point. But the reality is that you know, this, men have a really hard time when women get credit for anything because we are so used to getting all the credit ourselves. Like when you've been like the dominant class or whatever for so long, sharing power or credit with anyone else, it feels like an attack on you because it was just you for so long that got all the credit, you know? And so if anything starts moving towards equality or diversity, it's easy for a lot of people who were in the dominant class to feel like it's an attack on them and to get super defensive and try to discredit or do other horrible things. If you feel threatened by being in the dominant class and slowly losing that dominance towards something that's more equal and more diverse, that's a problem with you, not a problem with the results in the system. And I'm sorry, I'm probably butchering this because I'm not an expert in discussing things like this. So I apologize if I'm butchering this, but basically, like, anyone who feels, you know, threatened or or angry about a woman getting credit for an important scientific achievement, you know, you have to check yourself there. And secondly, I think it's worth pointing out that, like, the reality of any kind of large project, whether it's a product being developed or a scientific achievement like this, is that there's a team of people who work on it. There's lots of people involved usually. But we still tend to give a lot of credit to the leaders. Like, Steve Jobs didn't make the iPhone. He didn't invent it. He didn't manufacture it. He didn't write any of the software on it. He probably designed none of the hardware on it. But he gets a lot of credit for it because he was the leader of the company that made it at the time they made it. And forgive me, I'm not familiar with too many of the details of the various people's roles in this and, you know, what title or role Katie Bowman had, but it's totally in line with how people get credit for things usually in our society to say that this is hers, that this was her project, that she led this and they did this as a result of her. Like, this seems like the way we credit things in our society. You have to really bend over backwards to suggest that she shouldn't get credit for this.
I think if someone is listening to this would probably, and who's on the other side of it, would probably find everything you said unconvincing, because they would say, you're misunderstanding. That's not the situation at all. I'm not trying to discredit somebody. I'm not being a meanie. I'm not insecure. I'm not threatened. Really, all I'm doing is, two things. One, I'm being vigilant and skeptical against a trend I see in the world, which is that everyone is looking for a chance to raise up historically marginalized people and use them as examples of good. And I, as the rational skeptic internet person, dude, obviously.
it's always a dude.
I'm watching for that, because I think it would be very unfair to take somebody and hold them up as a great champion or someone who's very successful just because they're from a traditionally marginalized group. So anytime we see that happen, oh, look at this, someone's getting credit for a scientific discovery or achievement, and it's not a white guy, we should check this out, because we know how all those people out there are always just trying to champion anybody they see from a marginalized group. So let's check this out. We're not being mean or we're not insecure. We just got to check it out, because it just seems unfair to people should get credit when it's due to them, but when it's not due, I, the internet skeptic, I'm going to make sure that I'm on the prowl for that. And that happened a lot in, the typical places you would imagine, Hacker News or Reddit or whatever. And during that process, the self-anointed, extremely non-experts in the field have examined it, and aside from the super duper trolls, have basically come down. Okay, we looked into it, we checked it out, and despite some early suspicions about some things and some confusion about lines of code when people check model files into GitHub and it ends up with almost a million lines of code, and we're confused by that because we don't know anything. But we give us some credit, like self-appointed experts. We sorted it out, and we eventually determined that yes. She should get credit. She was like her algorithm and her idea, and she led the team and did all this important work, and it's checked it out and everything's fine. And those people would say, this is the system working as designed. We here as a self-appointed experts are ensuring that no one gets credit when they shouldn't, because that actually would be counter to the idea of, raising up marginalized people, right? So we want to make sure if they're getting credit, they should. And we looked into it and we checked it out and we had a discussion, a very rational discussion, and we debated. And aside from all the people who are currently downvoting, who are super duper jerks and misogynists, we determined it looks good. She should get credit. Everything's great.
Thank you for your service. And
if you have some kind of super tunnel vision and you just look at it from that lens, you're like, show me where something was wrong there. We were on the internet and we were just having a discussion about a thing and there were some doubts and we looked into it and we used our awesome rational men brains and we came to what we think is the truth. And it turns out in this case, the truth is what everyone wanted it to be, and it's a feel-good story and it's great. It's cool, right? And to the people who either participate in that or can identify with that or like hear that and think, I mean, that makes sense. How can you argue with that? Like, show me the lie. What's wrong about that? It's the tunnel vision. You're missing the larger context. And larger context is that every time anyone from a marginalized group gets outside of their pen or raises above their station or like becomes slightly less marginalized for even a moment, they are accosted by the entire universe of the status quo saying, whoa, 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 hang on a second. Let's examine everything about this. Can we get a DNA sample? Is that really you? Can we talk to everyone you ever knew? Did you steal a candy bar when you were in fifth grade? Because I might have to put you like, and that just doesn't happen when it's a white guy. When it's a white guy, no one goes and examines everything about their life and interrogates to make sure that they did everything they said. And that is the lesson here. Not the specifics of this story, but the idea, like, put yourself in the shoes of a marginalized person and see what it would be like that when you know, even if you have any kind of 100% deserved success, the main story will be everyone else trying to, even the best people, quote unquote, make sure that you really deserve it. And that just doesn't happen to other people. And they say, well, no, I do that for everybody. Every scientific paper, I just make sure that all the male credits get it. They don't. It's not the way, writ large, is not the way the world works. That is the lesson here, that you can't just look at the single case and say, everyone, the system worked the way it was supposed to, and we're just doing our job. You have to look at the larger context. You have to put yourself in the shoes of one of those people and say, what is it like when anytime anything goes well for you, the main thing you have to deal with is attacks and doubts systemically because of who you are? And that's the disappointing part, and that's the part that you'll never be able to argue with because you're trying to tell the people, like, I don't know about the analogies, are trying to explain water to a fish or whatever, that it's just the world they're living in. It's the world everyone's swimming in, and especially if they can't relate or don't have enough experience being empathetic to that position, or haven't heard enough, like haven't listened to enough people explaining, here's what it's like to be me. Like, I don't know how many ways we can get at like the idea of empathy, but like it's a difficult, you can't explain empathy to someone. I mean, you can intellectually, but you have to, you know, it's the point of empathy. You have to feel it to make the connection to say, what would it be like to be a woman in science, right? What does that entail? And how is it different than being a man in science? And you can't look at one single case and say, well, everything there was justified. You have to look at the big picture and the big context and people as a group and understand the injustice. And it's a difficult concept to get across. And I feel like sometimes it gets lost in any specific case of arguing over the details of, like, you know, GitHub source code and stuff. It's like, why are we even that far down the rabbit hole here? Think about why is this even happening? Anyway, that's my angle on this whole story.
John, I freaking love you. Thank you for that. No, I really mean it. I hope I don't sound sarcastic, but especially when it comes to this sort of thing, you do such a good job of taking my jumbled thoughts and making them make sense. So I appreciate it.
And, yeah, I'm really glad that you are here to speak for us.
Yeah, because Marco and I are trying real hard. We really, really are. Doesn't mean we're succeeding, but we're trying.
No, I'm afraid to talk about a lot of stuff like this because I'm not good at it. And I think if I talk about these kind of things poorly, I'm probably making things worse.
Well, I mean, I think both of you and a lot of people, like, you know, myself included, like the first instinct is often like, you feel the injustice. Like, you have enough empathy to understand, like, this seems like I can imagine what it might be like, and this feels unjust. And like, and part of it is tribal and teams. And like, if you are sort of for more equality for women or any other marginalized group, if you're for that, you instinctively root for that, quote unquote, that side. You can get caught up in that part of it. And in general, if you see someone being attacked and you feel like that, as far as you're concerned, you probably think it's unjust, you feel bad and you rebel against the injustice and you get mad about it and you get worked up or whatever. But like, fighting the battles from that perspective, like my side versus your side and us arguing or whatever, can lead to the situation where everything gets settled as it mostly got settled in these threads that were not in the, you know, that are in the more reasonable parts of the internet. And everyone thinks, okay, well, we worked it out. The system works. And I feel like, especially if the answer turns out like your side is the one on the right, like, oh, it's great. You know, and if you still disagree, you're a bad person, but all the other people agree. Like the trap is thinking that is the system working and not understanding that whole debate is regardless of how it turned out, even, you know, regardless of just the fact that we're discussing this at all, it's like all the things with like repeating lies. Like, I'm hesitant to even have this topic in the show just because discussing it at all gives credence to the idea that a woman was getting credit when she shouldn't, even though that is not the case. You know, studies have shown if you just repeat a lie over and over again, it gains more weight in people's minds, despite how, you know, how wrong it might be, despite everyone agreeing that it's wrong because they heard it so many times, like, it's wrong, but it's probably a thing that probably happens a lot. And it could have happened in this case. It just happened to not happen. And that's the worst part about it. That is the fact that it happens, and that's the systemic oppression that is difficult to explain, but is probably more significant than the details of any individual case.
Yeah. Preach. No, I just wanted to call it out because I really think it's too bad. And I'm glad that, John, you were there to clean up our mess.
Yes, so, thank you.
What we really talk about is all the videos I saw explaining how cool, like why the image looks the way it does. I tweeted it. We should put it in link in the show notes. There was a Veritasium, I think. If you had watched, when Interstellar came out, the same stuff went around. Like I said, here's why is the black hole Interstellar look the way it does. Well,
I didn't see it.
We consulted scientists, and they told us this is the way it looks. And like, it's all true. And there were explainer stories back then. It's all just come back around now. But I thought that Veritasium thing with the model was a pretty concise way to explain it that had the advantage of glossing over the details that aren't that important. You basically just want to know why does it look like a black spot with a fuzzy ring around in this particular, you know, like why does it look anything like that? You don't want to know the super duper details of why the Interstellar one looks exactly like that. Well, the Interstellar one leaves out some details as well for cinematic reasons, but we will put that link in the show notes to get something positive out of this. If you're wondering why the hell does a picture of the black hole look like a coffee stain in the sky, we have a video that will answer that question. And the answer is cool. Like, the answer is not, oh, it's like black, but with stuff around it. The answer is cool because black holes are cool.
Also, if your coffee is that color, you're doing something wrong.
It's not actually color. It's a false color image, Marco. They just assign colors to levels of, it's fine. You can make it any color you want.
We are brought to you this week by Jamf Now. Go to jamf.com/ATP to learn more and create your free account. Jamf Now makes it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices at work. As a business grows, so does its digital inventory, and this makes it harder to manage everyone's Apple devices. This is especially true if you have remote employees. With Jamf Now, you can check on your digital inventory, you can distribute Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy apps to everyone, enforce passcode requirements, and protect your company's data. You can even lock or wipe a device remotely if necessary from anywhere. Jamf Now helps you manage your devices so you can focus on your business instead, and there's no IT experience needed to use Jamf Now. So our listeners, start securing your business today. You can manage your first 3 devices for free, and you can add more after that, starting at just $2 a month per device. So create your free account today at jamf.com/ATP. That's jamf.com/ATP. Thank you so much to Jamf Now for sponsoring our show.
Apple and Qualcomm have settled, and within hours of that, Intel has decided, yeah, maybe this 5G thing ain't for us after all.
I like this story because it's so neat. so we know that Apple and Qualcomm have been not friends for a long time. Qualcomm sells the modem chips that let your phone talk to the cell network, and it's a super important part of your phone. Qualcomm has tons of patents. There's all sorts of lawsuits about Qualcomm not licensing those patents to people for reasonable rates, and Apple not wanting to pay license fees because they felt like they're already paid by the manufacturers, and blah blah blah, like big legal battle. They're super not friends. In the last round of iPhones, and maybe a little bit of the one before, Apple has been getting its cell modems from Intel while it fights with Qualcomm. And as we've said many times in this program, Apple's solution to this problem long term is screw you, Qualcomm, and Intel, we'll make our own modem chips. But that takes a long time. Apple is still pursuing that strategy, but in the meantime, it's got phones to make and phones to sell. And I haven't really been paying attention to this battle. I didn't know like the first day of the court case between Apple and Qualcomm happened, and there's a separate thing where Qualcomm's being in a thing with the FTC about licensing. Anyway, the situation came to a head for a variety of reasons. One, Intel is having, as we all know, having problems getting its 10-nanometer process online still. That's why we have 14-nanometer chips in all our Macs. And it's kind of important. if Intel wants to continue to make these, you know, sell radio chips for phones, it has to be able to match the process that Qualcomm is going to be able to fab on with Taiwan Semiconductor or whatever. And Intel has seemed a little bit shaky about the idea of whether it really wanted to be in this business, because it's kind of, compared to giant server chips where it's the dominant force, it's a lower margin business, and Apple is a difficult customer and all that stuff. So the way it came to head is, and I'm not sure about the order of events at the time we're recording this, is still some speculation, but I assume the order of events is Apple's hanging out there. It's like Apple's fighting with Qualcomm, and Intel's supposed to be making its cell radio chips. In particular, you know, Intel was going to make the 5G radio chips for not this phone, maybe, but the next phone. And Intel's not doing too well. And Apple's like, we're kind of between a rock and a hard place. We're making our own chips, but we're not going to be ready in time for the next iPhone. Intel's making chips, but they might not be ready because we know they're having trouble with their process, and we don't want them to fab it on the bigger process. And Qualcomm, we're in a fight with. So what do we do? And sort of simultaneously, Intel says, you know what? Forget it. We're not making 5G cell modems, right? Apple settles with Qualcomm, basically, at, you know, not to say Apple lost, but they basically lost. Apple settles with Qualcomm, makes nice with Qualcomm, and does like a cross-licensing agreement, which they need to be able to make their own cell modem chips, because Qualcomm has all the important patents, and patents are evil. But also, like, agrees to pay them some huge amount of money that they supposedly owed them. Like, because what choice do they have? Once Intel stops, Intel either can't or doesn't want to make 5G, you know, cell modems in time for Apple. Apple has to make up with Qualcomm, because otherwise it would have no cell radios in its phones, and that's really bad. So this is all nice and neat, where Apple basically loses, Intel also kind of loses, I feel like, and Qualcomm also kind of loses, because, you know, so Apple loses because they end up paying Qualcomm when they didn't want to, and their whole idea of playing Intel against Qualcomm didn't work out. Intel loses, I think, because this is another situation where Intel says, we like our high-margin businesses better. And Intel apparently can't get its act together to get its, you know, process shrink online. And they just, you know, remove the risk. Like, let's not deal with that whole Apple thing, because Apple's a demanding customer and we're not even sure we want to be in this business and whatever, right? But it's not a strength move for Intel. If Intel was super duper awesome and had the best fab like it did many years ago, it would be able to serve Apple and sell tons of a chip, and it would have been good for them. So they lose. And then Qualcomm loses because, regardless of the deal with Apple, they know that Apple is making its own cell radio chips, and they just gave Apple the license, the patent licenses that it needs, so that in a year or two or three, Apple's not going to be buying chips from Qualcomm anymore either. So everybody loses in giant corporation, you know, courtroom bingo, whatever the hell we're playing here. Now, what do you guys think of the order of operations was here? Was it Intel voluntarily bailed, or Apple knew that Intel wasn't going to be able to make it and bailed on Intel? It's kind of like who gets to announce first, because I can imagine Apple in their boardroom going, who here is confident that Intel is actually going to be able to give us cell radio chips, 5G radio chips, and no one raises their hand. They're like, maybe we should just tell Intel, you know what, forget it, and we should settle with Qualcomm. And before they even tell Intel that, Intel gets a wind of it and says, you know what, no, we're out of the 5G business. We weren't going to make you things anyway. Forget it.
And then you can't Apple fire me. I quit.
Yeah, like I have no idea what the order is there. And then Apple settling with Qualcomm. Qualcomm's lawyers would be more than happy to say, so Apple, here you want to settle. Well, here's how much money we want, and we'll do that cross-patent licensing. Like, depending on when those things happened, the negotiation between Apple and Qualcomm could have been, you know, more or less in Apple's favor. But I can't tell exactly what order things happened here. But I really do feel like that everybody loses in some way.
Yeah, if I were to wager a guess, I would say that Intel knew it was screwed. I don't know if that got messaged to Apple or not, but I think Intel knew it was screwed. Apple thus knew it was screwed. And I bet you Apple said to Intel, never mind on this whole thing. And then Intel said, oh, thank God. I mean, oh, that's too bad. Okay.
Yeah, this, the whole Qualcomm Apple thing, this is two big companies that were fighting over a lot of money. I honestly don't think Apple had a leg to stand on. I'm not a legal expert, but it sure seemed like Apple just decided, we don't want to pay this anymore, so we're just going to stop, and you can sue us, and we'll see what happens. Like, that's kind of how it seemed. And we were all willing to kind of forgive that or throw it away, because anyone who looks into this at all learns quickly that Qualcomm is, like, not a great actor most of the time. Like, it is, it it really uses like horrible like predatory licensing and pricing and they're really a big bully. So
well, that there was the other case involving like the FTC of saying it's not just like they're being mean. Like legally, Qualcomm is supposed to allow people to use its patents for some reasonable fee or whatever. Like there's some like that case is ongoing, right? So Apple's bet was, I bet we can just not pay them because they're going to be so screwed because we know they're in the wrong with this FTC thing, and I bet they're going to lose that case. And let's just not pay them because they'll be distracted by that thing. And maybe if they lose that case, like maybe we'll get, you know, and the gamble didn't pay off for Apple. Like they like either the case took slowly or maybe Qualcomm's going to win that case after all or whatever. Like, yeah, so it was kind of it's a thing companies do all the time, a game of chicken of like, we have a lot of money and a lot of lawyers, so let's just not do a thing and, you know, come at me, right? And it could have been that if the timing worked out differently, that Qualcomm might have been in hot water with this patent thing and been willing to overlook Apple doing that in exchange for some sort of deal that for Apple to continue buying its cell phones or whatever. Anyway, like, both Apple and Qualcomm were being big corporate jerks, but I feel like Qualcomm had sort of the original sin. Well, the patent system is the original sin of like, of having these patents and hoarding them and charging a lot for them in a way that made everybody unhappy and that is probably illegal according to the letter of the already absurd patent law, right? And then after that, it's like, well, Apple gets super cranky about that, and then it does something that is probably also illegal, and then, you know, he started it is not a great argument legally speaking, but it's the reason I think that Qualcomm is the worst actor here.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like I honestly didn't like the way Apple handled this. Like, it sure seemed like Apple was cutting off their money in order to hurt them financially, like fatally. Like, I think Apple decided to stop paying them, hoping that not only would they lose so much revenue that they would be forced to negotiate, but that they would that their stock price, because they're a public company, that their stock price would go down so much that, like, I think Apple was basically trying to strangle Qualcomm out of existence by just not paying something that by like their contract, like they clearly owed the money, and Apple just decided we're going to stop paying and see what happens. And that's kind of a big bully move right there. So I don't like the way Apple did this, even though I don't like Qualcomm either. I think Apple went about this in a very like big bully kind of way. But regardless, it seems to be over now for the time being, because Intel can't get their crap together, and that's not really news to anybody.
Nope.
Long term, I think Apple will get their cell modem team going quickly enough that I think maybe in 5 years they won't need to deal with Qualcomm anymore. But we're not there yet.
Yeah, I don't know how long their patent license is, but I feel like with Qualcomm, like, it's short-sighted to take the giant bucket of money that Apple gave them. I mean, I guess Qualcomm has no choice. Like, the point is they have to license them, and so now they have. But now that gives Apple the keys to be able to be the master of its own destiny and do its own chips. I feel like Apple's one regret is probably, we should have started that make-your-own-modem thing 2 years ago. Like, 2 years earlier than we did. Not 2 years ago. Right. Whenever they started it, starting it 2 years before that would have saved them from this whole mess. And Intel, I'd love to talk to Intel and say, guys, like, I know you're having trouble with your process thing, but like this whole idea of let's stick to the high margin multi-core, like 58 core, $30,000 server thing because it's a better business. Like, it kind of is. But how many times are you going to skip out on making the cheap consumer commodity part in large numbers because it's a low margin business? Like, that's, you can do that when, you know, if you're coming from a position of strength, but you're not anymore. Like, I'm not saying they have to take every single deal, but Intel has a history of, like, they passed on making the iPhone CPU. I'm sure they've passed on making stuff for game consoles, like all sorts of businesses that don't look as good to them as their high margin multi-core x86 CPU businesses. It's true, they're not as good businesses, but the volumes are high, and if you skip all of those, eventually the world just leaves you behind, and every device that matters is using something other than an Intel chip in it. I mean, I'm sure they have, you know, better reasons than I can think of right now, but it just seems like not a great thing for Intel to be like constantly retrenching, because eventually the only thing they're going to sell are the equivalent of mainframe chips, and there's not going to be a lot of them.
Well, I think ultimately one reason that they might have had to, you know, retreat on this one is, like, Intel obviously has two big problems in this market. Number one is they can't get their crap together to even ship their existing products. Like they can't even keep their mainstream, like, product line going at a healthy rate without massive problems. And so that's problem number two is that the right time to get into the cell modem business was 10 years ago. Like, they're a little late. And so I imagine anyone who tries to enter this business now, including Apple, probably has a pretty serious set of problems on their hand that A, they're starting from zero, and B, they have patent issues, major, major patent issues. And that's just, that's the kind of thing that does not get solved quickly or easily. Like, if you wanted to start a cell modem business today, as Apple apparently is rumored to have done or has actually said they're doing, whatever it is, that's a massive undertaking that is going to take years and years and years before there's going to be any payoff whatsoever. And even then, as soon as you release something, Qualcomm is going to sue you, and that's going to take years and years to resolve, and you might be on the hook for lots of money after that. So, like, there's just a lot of challenges in entering the market of cell modems now, today. Which is like, and Intel started a few years ago, but like, they didn't start 10 years ago or 15 years ago when they probably should have.
Well, we're all holding Intel cell modems in our phones right now, as we all have a 10S, right? And I think Intel has been Apple supplier while they've been fighting with Qualcomm. So they've had some success in that area. Like, I don't think that any, you know, remember the year when they had the, you could get the Intel modem and you could get the other modem, and there was debates about
which was the iPhone 7 and I had the Intel one and it sucked.
Right. But since then, you know, it's been a non whatever, you know, however good they might be compared to the Qualcomm ones, it's obviously Intel's modems have been good enough that we have not had any discussions about the quality of the cell radios in our current iPhones or the previous gen or whatever. So, like, but I guess that business was not, you know, attractive to Intel, you know, and the process issue comes to a head where eventually everybody else offers, you know, Taiwan Semiconductor 7-nanometer things, and Intel can't match that. What does Intel do? Like, maybe concentrate. You know, so it's not like Intel starting from zero. They're already making cell modems. It's just a question of, can you make a 5G one? And it's a larger effort. And as for being sued by Qualcomm, like, everybody has to license these patents, and the whole idea is that Qualcomm's supposed to let people license them, and that's what that whole FTC argument is about. But Apple's cell modem thing, I think, started several years ago. So I think they're sort of on track to be in the 2020 or 2021 iPhone, which, you know, it's reasonable timeline given how long things take. If they'd started a year or two earlier, things would be better. But as things stand, you know, I was saying everybody loses in some way. Everybody does, but Apple probably loses the least, because the main thing Apple lost is, you know, the public opinion, like, they're the loser in this thing, and it's clear, right? You know, if you care about the horse race, like, Apple versus Qualcomm, who won? Basically Qualcomm. But the main thing Qualcomm won is a bunch of money, and Apple has a lot of that. And long term, what Apple won is, you know, its freedom eventually.
We are sponsored this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com/ATP. Enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. Squarespace makes it super easy to make amazing websites. It's as simple as that. These days, everything needs a website. Every new project you might want to do, existing businesses or projects you want to show off to the world, maybe a new podcast you want to start, or a new store you want to open up online for digital or physical goods. Squarespace can help you with all of those things. From the simple to the advanced, they make everything super easy for you, no matter what your skill level is, with no coding required. With Squarespace's intuitive, easy-to-use tools, you can customize it all to your heart's content to fit whatever your preferences or your branding requirements might be. And this is great whether you're starting a site for yourself or someone else, because Squarespace offers amazing support and they keep the site running, so it's not your problem. You don't have to deal with upgrading your site whenever there's a new version of a CMS or anything like that. You don't have to worry, what if my site goes down? You don't have to think about any kind of manual coding or anything. Squarespace takes care of all of that for you. It's incredibly easy to use. And then you can take all that time you're saving and maybe money you're saving by not focusing on all those things. And you can focus on whatever your business or project needs instead. Because it's boring to focus on the website. You don't want to deal with that. You want Squarespace to take care of all that for you. And then you can focus on your business. See for yourself at squarespace.com/ATP. And you can start your site for free with a free trial. No credit card required. When you decide to sign up, make sure to head back there, squarespace.com/ATP, and use offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Once again, squarespace.com/ATP, code ATP for 10% off your first purchase. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace.
It was a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago now, that Apple had 3 or 4 consecutive days of releases and embargoes and things of that nature. Well, friend of the show, Guy Rambo, has decided to mimic that, but with leaks. So this has been the week of leaks, and we are recording on Wednesday the 17th. I genuinely don't know if more stuff is coming or not, but holy cow, it's been a busy last several days. So this started, I think, on the 13th, which is actually last week. That would be Saturday, with iOS 13 rumors, specifically dark mode, detachable panels, Safari and Mail upgrades, an undo gesture, a new volume heads-up display, and more. So this starts with Guy Rambo saying, long-awaited dark mode is finally coming to the iPhone and iPad with iOS 13. There'll be system-wide dark mode that can be enabled in settings, including a high-contrast version similar to what's already available in macOS. And speaking of macOS, the iPad apps that run on the Mac using Marzipan will be able to take advantage of dark mode on both platforms. Additionally, there are many changes coming to the iPad with iOS 13, including the ability for apps to have multiple windows. Each window will be able to contain sheets that are initially attached to a portion of the screen, but then can be detached with a drag gesture, becoming a card that can be moved around freely, similar to what an open source project called PanelKit could do. And I think I heard on Upgrade that apparently the developer of PanelKit now works for Apple,
correct,
which I did not know. So that's kind of interesting as well. Anyway, these cards can also be stacked on top of each other and use a depth effect to indicate which cards are on top and which are on the bottom. Cards can be flung away to dismiss them. That's a lot, and that's just day one.
Yeah, all these things sound like, I mean, dark mode we more or less knew was coming. The volume HUD, as noted in the article, has been a joke for such a long time. It's one of those overdue things. The complaint about the volume HUD, in case you're new to iOS or don't see anything wrong with it, is that when you change the volume, a gigantic square comes in the middle of your screen and hides things that are behind it. Lots of apps override that, and we all love those apps where you can, I mean, Instagram is an example, but basically any good player or application or whatever replaces the volume HUD with a tiny thing that is tucked into an unused portion of the screen due to like letterbox video or whatever, or is at the very top at the very bottom and just shows like a line filling or whatever. So the article doesn't say what it's going to be, but anything other than a giant thing in the middle of the screen that obscures the video will be great. The Mail upgrade I thought was interesting because the Safari and Mail stuff, they talk about those applications getting more features, which after last week's show where we were worried about Marzipan apps coming to the Mac and just being like Macified equivalents of their iOS versions that don't have a lot of features. Maybe it wasn't entirely clear in the last show, or I think we mentioned a few times, we're like, we don't know what the Marzipan apps that come to the Mac are going to be like. Like, we're worried that they might have far fewer features, but we don't actually know. So here is one of the first rumors that's not even about the Mac, it's about iOS, and saying, hey, the Mail application on iOS might get some new features added to it, which happens from time to time in small amounts, but it turns the knob slightly towards the possibility that Marzipan apps on the Mac might not be as feature poor as they are in iOS 12, especially if the iOS 13 incarnations have a bunch more features. Now, maybe they have a bunch more features because those features were added partially in service of the Marzipan version, which would be the advantage of Apple being able to put a single team on Mail for all of its platforms. So when they add features, they don't need to add them to the iOS version and to the Mac version. They just add it to one version. I don't know. But anyway, that I found that, encouraging. And then the undo gesture, what they say is like 3 fingers on the keyboard and a swipe. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's better than shaking the phone, but it's still an awkward gesture. And if the keyboard is up, as Gruber pointed out, you've got undo and redo buttons right above the keyboard most of the time anyway. So I'm not entirely sure how awesome that's going to be, except trying to explain to people how they accidentally, they did a bunch of typing and then it all disappeared. And it's like, oh, you accidentally 3-finger swiped on your keyboard because you were typing really fast or something. But hopefully that gesture, like the other multitasking gestures, will be able to be turned off or whatever. But anyway, all these things, they sound good to me. These features sound good. None of them sound stupid or frivolous or, particularly unexpected, except for the addition of features to the applications.
Yeah, this, I mean, the keyboard undo thing, I don't really care about, honestly. That's yet another multi-finger, complex, undiscoverable gesture to fix keyboard navigation on iOS. Like, no one's going to find it.
Assuming that even ships, by the way, because that type of feature is very easy to, like, play with and have experimentally in builds and say, you know what, never mind.
Right. And and I do think if you look at the information that they are reporting here in these various reports that we've gotten over the last few days, it sure seems like this is coming from, like, a class dump or some it seems like somebody has access to a build, but I don't think Guy Rambo has a build, because if he had a build, he could get things like resources and images and things out of that build that could probably be more newsworthy than, like, the features that might exist. So I'm guessing this is reporting on somebody who has access to a class dump of the build, because it's sounding like, you know, features that might exist in the SDK and that might have, like, you know, function names and class names that can be seen in the SDK. That's what this sounds like to me. And based on that, then that supports what you said, John, like, that this might not ship. Like, there might be a class called, like, you know, keyboard multi-finger undo gesture or something like that, but that might not be enabled at the end, or, you know, whatever build ships. Even if that's enabled, like, at the WWDC seed, that still might not ship this fall. So that's all that aside. The multi-window panel kit-like thing, I think, is very interesting. There's a lot of challenges with getting rich functionality in iOS. And part of it, you know, initially, you know, in the early days of iOS, there were hardware limitations, there were screen size limitations, there were limitations in the kind of sophistication that the software could even enable in any reasonable way. But over time, many of those limitations have gone away or have been significantly lifted. The hardware is now more powerful than many laptops, even many desktops like John's.
brutal.
The software is incredibly capable. There's tons of APIs. But one of the biggest challenges that we still have on iOS and in all touch-based OSs is, how do they expose complex functionality in a way that is discoverable at all and that works with touch and that isn't hideously ugly or confusing? And those are really hard design challenges. One of the cool things about PanelKit is that it basically is like an extension of popovers. It basically, like, treats popovers as, like, detachable panes that you can then, like, dock into a sidebar, is kind of how I can summarize this. And it does this with minimal new UI. And as we think about how to expand, especially the iPad, like, on the phone, you're kind of limited by screen size and, you know, oftentimes you need to operate things one-handed, and so not needing controls to be very far away or near the corners or anything. So, like, on the phone, I don't think we have a lot of UI innovation left to do with, like, multitasking and advanced operations, because there just isn't space, really. But on the iPad is where things get really interesting, and especially as you think about now, like, combining iPad and Mac designs in the future, or having designs that can adapt to both very easily. The iPad suffers still so much from a lack of progressive disclosure of complexity and a lack of advanced functionality being present, even in pro apps for things like customizing your workspace, things like multitasking, having multiple windows or multiple tabs or whatever open and various things. And so to have strong rumors of significant progress in those areas is very exciting to me. Now, even though we don't really know much of anything about what any of these things mean, how they're actually implemented, things like that, I am extremely excited about the apparent amount of work going into this. That Apple seems not to think that the iOS 11 version of multitasking is done. Like, it's like sometimes Apple solves a problem and then they don't come back to it for years, if ever. And they kind of, you can tell they kind of just think, like, well, that's a solved problem. Check, done. And clearly iPad multitasking is not done. Clearly they have other plans, and they want to make things more advanced for both multitasking and for what you can do inside of one app. And that, combined with Marzipan and everything, I'm very excited, even though we know so little, I'm very excited to see where all this goes. And I think, it's hard to know for sure, because there's so much that's still speculation, optimistic predictions, wish list type things. But I think Apple has their head on straight again, after some years kind of in the wilderness with lots of different things regarding power users and pros and hardware and software, it sure seems like they have their heads on straight again. And that's why I'm optimistic that this is going to be good.
I think Apple's still taking a pretty cautious approach here. Like, and the main problem, I feel like, is that nobody knows the answer yet, including Apple. So if you look at the sort of more complex applications in the iPad, they've all been experimenting with different ways to deal with complexity of user interface in their own way. And none of them is so clearly the one and only way. Apple, and none of them come from Apple. So if you are making a sort of professional complex iPad application, you're kind of on your own. You can look at your competitors and you can come up with some ideas on your own. You can try some experiments, but there's no OS framework level standard for the type of things that you need to do. You need to invent it yourself. So I feel like what Apple's doing here is not like we've come up with an entirely new paradigm of how to use the iPad. It's, well, I can see a bunch of apps out there that are complex enough that they need more than we offer, and sort of look at what they all do. And what is the main need that most people are filling? And I guess maybe, you know, according to this rumor, it's like decided like, well, you need some way to have some kind of panel card thingy that is not like a full-fledged window. It's not like a, you know, we're not turning into a multi-window interface where you have separate documents open in separate windows, but it's like you have bits of your user interface and you want to be able to break them out and arrange them. And so we're going to provide a system-level framework to do that one thing, which doesn't seem like it's that significant. It's like, well, I could do that already if I rolled my own. It's true, but by Apple, not really picking a winner, but by Apple sort of putting its foot down and saying, this is an important enough need that there should be a system, standard system control for it. And you won't have to write it, and we will hopefully make it good enough that we'll encourage you to use it in your app. It will save you a lot of development time, and if a bunch of people use it and find it useful, their apps will work more like each other. It's the whole point of the GUI, that if you learn one app, you can transfer those skills to another. But there are so many issues with dealing with complex operations on the iPad. This does not solve all of them. It, you know, to your point, Marco, it shows that they are going in the right direction. They're recognizing this need, and they're not going to be like, well, we've done all that we need to do, and people can just make their own custom apps with their own custom UIs, right? Like, everything's going to be Kai's Power Tools. Well, it may be a reference before your time, but, like, do completely...
No, I got it.
Yeah, like, we don't provide controls for the giant, scaly, you know, speckled orb, but you can make one of your own, and then, you know, anyway... So I'm happy that they're doing this, but it's still very cautious. Like no one has the full sort of here is a sort of regular toolkit for dealing with complexity, dealing with functional complexity. You know, the Mac has a very regularized toolkit for dealing with functional complexity. It may not be the world's best toolkit, but it is eminently composable and involves windows, resizable windows, menu bars, palettes. Like there's very few sort of nouns and verbs, but you can compose them on a very large screen to solve very complex problems. It doesn't make for a particularly friendly interface, but you can get the functionality out there and you can make an application that lets people create an on-screen environment where they can get their work done. Witness every pro application you could possibly imagine, right? You know, Photoshop and Logic and CAD applications and all, you know, like anything with lots of menu commands and lots of floating windows and toolbars and palettes, right? Simply porting that to the iPad is probably not the right thing to do, but they've got to do something. So, and keep in mind that everything we're seeing in iOS 13 supposedly is stuff that might have been in iOS 12, but they decided let's not ship it half-baked and saved it. So hopefully when it comes in 13, it'll be nice and polished. But I still think even after 13, like we're on this sort of a 2-year Vitici cycle where he has to wait around for enhancements to the iPad, and then he gets a huge amount of them, and then there's a quiet year, and then he gets another huge amount. I really hope this is a big year. Like, you know, obviously these are just rumors and we have no idea what's really coming, and there could be way more than even these rumors suggest. But this seems like a year where the iPad's going to get a bunch of stuff. But I mean, we'll wait and see. But I still feel like from the rumors so far, there is not a grand unified vision of how to deal with functional complexity on the iPad, but there is one more tool in the tool belt that seems to be mostly based on the sort of real world research and development done by third-party developers coalesced into an Apple blessed version, which is great. That's the way many things work. And the Apple world, and it's fine. But I think there's also room for the other side of that, which is Apple coming up with a really good idea and rolling that out. And, you know, that might be coming too. There's another rumor later on, if we get to it, from macOS, that potentially relates to some of Apple's ideas about how to deal with that. But in the meantime, I still feel like Apple is being cautious, and that caution is probably warranted.
You know, I'd be interested to see or try to discover how this is implemented on the iPad versus on the Mac. Like, let's say that we get Panel Kit. Obviously, it'd be different, but for the sake of conversation, we need a name for it. So let's say we get Panel Kit on the iPad on iOS, but then we also have to support that. Well, not we. Apple has to support that on macOS, potentially, because Marzipan. I can't help but wonder if the under-the-hood implementation would be very different, even if the APIs would be the same, you know? So what is actually, what on the iPad is not a new window is actually like an NS window or something like that on macOS. And to be fair, I know very little about macOS programming, so I might have already butchered the idea here. But do you know what I mean? Like, it would be fascinating to me if there was one API that was common between macOS and iOS, but the implementation was wildly different between the two.
That's the old world. That's the old world of like share sheets and extensions and things that are ostensibly the same and have very similar APIs, but are implemented totally differently under the covers. I feel like the promise of Marzipan is, and actually they're implemented the same way under the covers because it's all UIKit under there. Like, I don't know if they're in a position to pull that off. And who knows how, you know, Marzipan is implemented on under the covers, whether it underneath that there is some, you know, AppKit stuff lurking. Who knows? Like, historically, we have Carbon and Cocoa as examples of two APIs that were separate but also had a surprising amount of sharing, where it was very difficult to make any Mac application that was purely Cocoa or purely Carbon back when they were sort of mixed together in various bits under the covers. But I think the promise of this new system is, let's not do that anymore, and let's literally have the same framework that runs on both platforms. And granted, with behavioral differences, to your point, Casey, that you can't actually make them the same because, I mean, the Mac just doesn't work like iOS. Everything's not trapped inside this one frame, and like having a panel, you know, like you can't on the iPad, you can't really take a thing outside the bounds of the thing because some window is always filling up the whole screen. Like, you can't, there's no, as far as I'm aware, no one has ever, there is no way in iOS to peek, you know, behind the currently running application, like as if you could see like your springboard hiding behind there. Like, I don't even think it is behind there, right? It's not like it is on the Mac where your applications are floating on top of a bunch of other stuff, but that is the way it is on the Mac. So there's going to be different differences, but I really think the promise here is finally a unified code base underneath it all, even if it is super awkward for the first few years because it's just going to look like phone stuff.
All right, moving on. We also heard that Apple is revamping Find My Friends and Find My iPhone into a unified app. And additionally, they're going to develop a tile-like personal item tracking device. So this is several things in one. It's merging Find My iPhone, Find My Friends, which is fairly self-explanatory. And it seems like it'll carry through most of the features you would expect between the two. Apparently, the new app will create or will let you create your quote-unquote find network, which includes devices and family and friends and things from that of that nature. And then additionally, Apple also wants, this is reading from Guy now, Apple also wants users to be able to track any item, not just their Apple devices, using this new unified app. The company is working on a new hardware product known only as, quote, B389, by the people involved in its development. This new product will be a tag that can be attached to any item similar to other products like Tile. The tag will be paired to the user's iCloud account by proximity to an iPhone like AirPods. Users will be able to receive notifications when their device gets too far away from the tag, preventing them from forgetting the item the tag is attached to. And then finally, you can put this tag thing in lost mode, and then apparently it will show your own contact information on other people's iPhones if they happen to be within range of it, which is not, you know, brand new ideas, but seems like a really, really solid implementation thereof. I do use Find My Friends, particularly for Aaron, but occasionally for friends. And I very rarely use Find My iPhone, but man, when I need it, I am very happy to have it. I don't have any tiles or tile-like devices at the moment, but all this sounds really good. I mean, nothing earth-shattering, but all this sounds really good. How do you feel about this, Marco?
I am really intrigued. It sounds like a good idea. I mean, I don't think there's that much to say yet.
Mm-hmm.
I am very curious to see if that dedicated hardware item ships that would basically be like, you know, a tile replacement. It just seems unlike the kind of thing Apple would do.
Yeah.
So that just seems odd to me. So I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't ship. Or maybe it's some kind of odd, like not really meant for mass consumers kind of thing, like Bluetooth LE tags and things like, you know, like maybe you're supposed to use these for other, like, you know, business to business uses or who knows what. But anyway, I do think it's smart to take advantage of the fact that like Apple has a lot of access to Bluetooth proximity radios and things like that. The types of wireless communications, the kind of ad hoc communications that AirDrop is based on, where your phones don't have to know about each other to talk to each other. They don't have to be on the same network. They don't have to be on Wi-Fi at all necessarily, and they can like form their own little Wi-Fi network with a combination of Bluetooth and Wi-Fi that coordinates things. So they have access to these radios. They also have they started in I think the last or the one before that version of iOS where if you do things like turn off Bluetooth, if you have an Apple Watch paired which communicates over Bluetooth, it can still communicate with the phone. Like when you hit the Bluetooth off thing in Control Center, it turns off most Bluetooth devices, but not all Bluetooth devices. It leaves the Apple Watch connected if you have one. And so they've already kind of like broken the seal on making those radio off toggles not 100% off and not for all things and not all the time. So if they were to do something like this where a phone that's been told to iCloud that it's lost, maybe its radios get forced on and then it can talk to other devices through this Bluetooth based proximity system, and then it can be found better, and like the thieves, if it's stolen, can't just turn the radios off. They have to actually like power the whole phone down to prevent it from being found this way. So it seems like a cool idea. It's certainly probably going to be more useful to actually locate lost and stolen devices. So sounds pretty cool. I don't necessarily think they're going to broaden it to other products with this weird hardware tag thing, but just as a way to improve Find My iPhone, that sounds awesome. And I'm not entirely sure why Find My iPhone would ever be in the same app as Find My Friends.
I can tell you why. Like I'm so glad that they're combining these apps because there's a constant source of frustration for me, right? So I use Find My Friends, which is an inappropriately named application because I use it to find my family most of the time. and I think Find My Friends tries to be smart. Like it's trying to help you find a person. It's right there in the name of the application. But because we're a house full of multiple people and multiple devices, sometimes it's confused about like what it wants to be doing. So I'll try to find out where my daughter is and I'll go to Find My Friends and I'll see her little icon on the overhead view of my house. But I know she's not in my house, but her phone is in the house and it thinks by finding her phone, it has found her. What I wanted to do is find her watch, but Find My Friends, as far as I'm aware, doesn't give you that granularity. So you go to Find My iPhone and also an inappropriately named application, which lets you find all the devices that belong to anybody in your family. So I go to Find My iPhone and I select my daughter's Apple Watch and then I find out where she really is, right? Having two different applications, one that's like a limited sort of I'll guess which device you mean and the other one which just gives you a big list of devices, I want them combined. It's basically like I applaud the idea of helping me find the person and being smart about like whatever device the motion sensor says is moving or whatever. You know, I think that's a good idea. But I don't want to have to go to a different app if that thing gets it wrong. And in the end, the sort of very straightforward bottom level of like, just find my devices, I can use that to figure out what I want to do in the worst case. So combining them into a new application that is not called Find My Friends, that is also not called Find My iPhone, will really help. And history has shown that I am the only one in my family who understands this separation because very often they'll say, I tried to find out where somebody was and it shows they're here, but they're not really there. And, you know, I'm like, well, you have to use to find my iPhone. It's like, but I don't want to find an iPhone. It's like, I know, but it's not my phone. I want to find, you know, my daughter's. It's like, just, it's in that app. Trust me. Just scroll. Yep. Keep scrolling. There's more. See the list there. It's there. It's our daughter's devices and then pick her. Yeah. So I think that unification is long overdue, and it's a great idea. As for the tile thing, I mean, I don't know anything about weird hardware rumors. Apple has all sorts of ideas that it doesn't ship. The thing that occurred to me when I saw this was that could be a Logitech device, or, you know, Apple farms a lot of stuff out to other vendors these days. So just because it has a code name and there's code supporting it in the OS doesn't necessarily mean it's a first-party Apple product. It could be something that they essentially build for a third party and a third party sells or whatever. So anyway, I can also see it being an Apple thing because it would be a very small piece of white plastic, and Apple loves to sell us those.
Very, very true.
It could be square, even. A white plastic square? That is Apple's core demo.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. What if we did a rounded rect instead?
No, it'd have to be, what is it called? The
super ellipse? The Johnny Ive curve?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? Something shaped like an iOS app icon that's perfect for children to swallow.
Can't God. Go wrong.
Kids love apps.
We'll sell millions. All right, finally, or maybe not finally, but finally for tonight anyway, Mac OS 10.15 rumors. I'm happy to summarize this, but I have a feeling that, John, you and Marco are frothing at the mouth. John, do you want to take it away on this
one?
All
right, summarize? Oh, that's why I did all these things in bold. Okay, so this rumor is the ability to send any window of any app to an external display, which... a sentence that doesn't make much sense from a Mac user's perspective is, you're like, if I have multiple displays on my Mac, I can quote unquote send any window there. I just drag it there. That's how windows work. Again, getting back to the fairly flexible, generic, composable UI paradigm that is the Mac, with a bunch of resizable windows that you drag around, and the multi-screen paradigm where you have screens that you arrange in relation to each other in 2D space and that you drag the windows between the screens and all that stuff. But the key part here is the external display can be an actual external display connected to the Mac or even an iPad. Now, before I get to the iPad part, the sending part is in the vocabulary of people who are not my people, who full screen everything. And I can imagine if you have multiple monitors and full screening that it's still kind of a headache to get the things to display on the screens that you want and all that other stuff. So having either a better UI or a better API or both for sending a full screen window to the screen you want is great. But of course, when that other screen is an iPad, you know, what is that third party product? Is that Luna Display, maybe? There's a bunch of products that do that. It basically lets you use your iPad, your very expensive iPad with a very nice screen on it, as essentially an external display for your Mac, even though it's not connected to your Mac by a cable. It does it wirelessly, right? So that's cool. That's a great idea. And this feature is called Sidecar, which makes some sense. It's like your iPad is like a sidecar to your Mac.
I love that name. Don't even start. I love that name. I think it's delightful.
Yeah. And so, you know, it gives more details in the article about how you can move a window to an iPad in full screen mode or whatever. And apparently you can also, once you have that window on your iPad, again, it's a Mac. It's just your Mac displaying a Mac application or whatever, Marzipan application on your iPad as if it's an external display. But then you can take the pencil and draw on the iPad, and it counts as input for the Mac, which is super neat. And so it basically turns your iPad into a little sort of Cintiq-style tablet for your Mac. Presumably the lag is acceptable and all that other stuff. And then there's some more info about snapping windows to the side and doing all, you know, you've seen in Microsoft Windows, they have all sorts of features and keyboard commands that you accidentally hit that take windows and divvy, you know, like slamming the window against the right edge will make it fill the right third of your screen or the top half or the bottom half. There are tons of utilities for the Mac that do similar things. The Mac itself, the current version of macOS, has features vaguely related to this in terms of splitting the screen. Obviously, I'm not a fan of these features because I feel like that paradigm is not as pleasing to me as the paradigm of resizable windows, but lots of people do they feel comforted by the simplicity of having either one application fill their entire screen, or one application be on the right and one on the left, or one on the top or one on the bottom, or quadrants, or all sorts of tiling window manager stuff. So this seems like more features to help those people. Now, all that said, in my experience watching people who are not like me use the Mac, like basically most people using the Mac, I mentioned before that I see them all use full screen all the time, often because they're on laptops and that maximizes your, you know, the room you have for your content. I don't see a lot of people using tiling window managers. I don't see a lot of people using the existing features that were added in like Sierra or whatever for splitting the screen. They're not particularly obvious. It's not particularly obvious how to trigger them. And most people don't know third-party Mac applications exist at all. So how would they know to go find something like Moom or whatever and you know, use that? I think that on the, of all the people I've seen use iOS devices, I've seen more of them use split screen just because it is literally the only way to get more than one thing on the screen at a time that people find themselves forced to learn it. Like if you want to be, if you want to be more productive than just seeing one whole application full whole screen at any time ever, ever, you have to learn this. Whereas on the Mac, you never have to learn those gestures because you can just use regular resizable windows and you can just exit full screen mode. And not, again, not an option on the iPad. There is no exiting full screen mode on the iPad. All you can do is split it and swipe it and do all that other stuff. So these features are a little bit of a head scratcher for me because I feel like it's kind of adding enhancements to features that are not widely used anyway and that are generally both inferior and not as obvious as the existing features that the Mac uses to deal with multiple windows, essentially. But I'm glad they're doing something having to do with window management. And the sidecar thing sounds like a great way to sell more people iPads, because if you can use the iPad that you already bought as a really cool tablet for your Mac, especially if it has really good Apple Pencil support, that's great. Like that's, you know, that's a big win for everybody. If the lag is acceptable, like, who wouldn't want that? I mean, Wacom or however you pronounce the name of that company probably doesn't like it, but I'm kind of looking forward to that. And I, you know, it may be a reason that we could end up with a new iPad mouse, which thus far we've avoided. But if it can do this cool thing, especially if it's only for iPad Pros or some other feature like that, we might end up with a new one.
You know, as someone who does believe in full screening windows or split screening, I think this sounds really great. I really do. I think taking the window snapping, I can't remember the name of it, and I'm sorry, but whatever the snappy thing is that Windows does.
Like Microsoft Windows has, you're talking about that feature?
Yeah, yeah, where you just, you know, as, and you had described it earlier, John, where you, let's say, drag a title bar to the very right extreme edge of the screen, and then it takes up the right hand, and then the Windows will resize that window to take up half of the screen. Jay Stratch in the chat room is saying it's called Snap. That sounds right to me. But anyway, like that feature is super convenient, and pretty much everyone I've ever seen use Windows, even not power users, understand how that works and leverages it. I like having my window or my Mac screen split up into like tiles. I know that that drives you insane, John, but that's just the way I like to use my computer. And so anything that makes this better, I think sounds great. And the idea of having like a software-based Luna display also tentatively sounds good. I don't recall if Luna is sponsored in the past. I don't know if they're sponsoring in the future. I paid my own money for one, and I can tell you it is really freaking good, and I do love this thing. I love it even despite the fact that it takes up the one and only USB-C port on my poor laptop. But
Does it have the pencil support too?
I guess I've never really tried it, but I guess you can't really draw a pencil onto the Mac. No, I see your point. No, then I guess it doesn't. But again, I've never tried it, so I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, that would be the type of thing that would be, you know, easy for Apple to add and difficult for a third party to add if the OS didn't support it.
Sure.
Because you have to get those input events efficiently to software running on the Mac.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, again, I've never tried it. But I mean, even just the quote-unquote regular Luna display, it works stunningly well, and I really do like it. And when I do travel with just the MacBook and my iPad Pro, you know, say if I'm going to the library to do work or something, it is very convenient to have that. So all this sounds great. Sidecar sounds great. The snappy thing sounds great. The Wacom thing, whatever. I mean, it's not really for me, I don't think, but it's still cool. It's still very awesome if you're the kind of person that needs that sort of thing. So yeah, this isn't maybe, except maybe Sidecar. I don't know if this is quite as sexy as the other things we've talked about, but I'm in. I'm excited about it.
Real-time follow-up. The existing third-party app does it. It's called AstroPad. That lets you use the pencil. Turn your iPad into a professional graphics tablet. Yeah. So this is another example of...
Oh, and that's by Luna, yeah, actually. There you go.
Of Apple seeing what... seeing third-party applications are doing and then coming with the first-party implementation of it. But this is much more of a... I mean, this is a risk anytime you add something that could be an OS level feature. The risk is that Apple will eventually make it an OS level feature. In general, users like it when that happened, but the makers of the applications that are essentially Sherlocked probably don't like it. They can still exist because they can have features that Apple's never going to add and yada yada. And of course, they got to make all that money before Apple came out with this feature. But AstroPad folks are probably a little bit bummed if this rumor turns out to be true.
Well, and I think it is likely to be true, in part because it sounds like a really good idea. Also in part because we've been hearing about this for like 2 years. Like ATP Tipster told us about this back when he was still alive, before he perished in a maple syrup fire. He was talking about this like 2 years ago as like something that was about to ship for Mac OS. So we've been hearing about this for a long time. They've probably been working on it for a long time, since even before Lunar Display was a thing that we knew about. So this might be like a simultaneous invention kind of thing, not like they saw Lunar Display and had to ape it like 6 months later. I think they've been working on this for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the fact that the third-party apps could exist probably means there was some amount of plumbing was already there in the OS that they were able to build on top of. I think it's a type of feature that if you're Apple, it's easy to make an argument for. It's like it makes our products more valuable. Like it makes you more likely to buy both a Mac and an iPad because they're great products separately. And there's also a synergy where they work together. And we know people like to use tablets with screens on them, like the Wacom Cintiq thing. Like that is a product that has proven its popularity. But it's an extra purchase. And those tablets are not cheap. I own one sitting right here, and I think it was something like $800. Like, that's iPad level prices, and that tablet is useless when not connected to a Mac, unlike an iPad, which is not useless when not connected to a Mac. So this seems like a really good idea for everybody. The sending windows and the splitting, though, I'm not sure. Casey, I'm curious, when you see other people using Macs, you like to use the split stuff that I added a couple of years back. Do you see other people use that?
Well, it's hard to say, because now the only people I see using a Mac is my coworker, and she generally uses her iPhone. So Erin isn't on her Mac very often. And in fact, her poor MacBook Air, the same one that's been in the drink a couple times, I haven't updated to. It's about as updated in terms of OS as your cheese grater is. But I'm trying to remember when I was at work. I don't remember one way or the other seeing a lot of full screen stuff. My inclination is to say no, I did not see a lot of full screen use or split screen use. But
not full screen, but split screen specifically. Like full screen, whatever, but like saying for the people who were in full screen, did they even know the Mac OS splitting thing exists? Have you ever seen anyone use it besides yourself?
Not to my recollection, no. And to be honest, it's not terribly discoverable. Like what you have to do is you have to mash down on the green, I don't know what the technical term is, but the green light in the upper left of a window, you mash down on that and hold for a few seconds. And then it kind of like shrinks, or it makes that take up half it cues it up to take up half the screen. And then you can, make a selection of what you want the other half of the screen to be. Like it is by no means perfect, but it is workable. And I would love to have the like arrow snap style thing out of Windows.
Yeah, I think it is even less discoverable than the Microsoft Windows equivalent feature, because you could accidentally discover it on Windows pretty easily. And I think more people would use it on the Mac if it was more discoverable, or if there weren't other options. To be fair, I don't see a lot of people using the splits on the iPad either, but it's the same type of thing on Windows. I think you can accidentally discover that. Like I know, because I accidentally do whatever the slide in from the side, what do they call that, where you on iOS where you swipe from the side.
God, yeah,
I do it all the time. So even if you didn't know that feature exists, you may find yourself discovering it. And once you do discover, you're like, oh, that's useful, I can imagine that being useful. And then you just get annoyed when you do it accidentally. And that's not to complain about iOS, but like I don't know how tenable it is to like the I was saying before that Apple's being cautious with iOS 12, or 13 rather, and with the rumored features that we think they're adding for panels or whatever. And the main thing that Apple has thus far not been willing to let go of, which I think is probably the right move, but it's limiting them, is extending everything to the edge. Like the menu bar doesn't really exist as a system level thing in iOS, despite the fact that various iOS applications have toyed with having their own menu bar. The edges of the screen, like there is your thing always takes up the entire screen, which is a paradigm that was introduced when it was absolutely the right thing to do on a tiny little phone screen. But as like on the big iPad, that's bigger than laptop screens used to be. not being able to have any kind of margin or any kind of OS level permanent thing, whether it be a dock or a shelf or a menu bar or, you know, a toolbar or anything like that, and having everything extend all the way to the edges, means that you're fighting for, like, the reason you accidentally do that swipe over gesture, because if that gesture didn't exist, how would you get that thing that's invisibly off to the side? How would you get it? Every pixel on the screen is owned by a single application that has no idea about, like, the thing over there. The only way you can get that is to come up with some kind of gesture, because there's nothing on the screen and no way to invoke a thing other than a gesture to say, application, this is not for you. I'm telling the OS, show me the little thing that's off to the side or whatever. If you didn't extend all to the edges or any kind of OS level UI or Chrome anywhere on the iPad, you would have some kind of, like, escape hatch, porthole. Like, imagine if it was just, like, one little square, like a tiny little Apple menu or something. Some part of the screen that is owned by the OS that you could use to tell it, the OS, to do something related to windowing. But we don't have that. All we've got are gestures and, you know, swipes and, used in the old days, double tapping the home button. Like, anything out of band, anything that we can say, application, this is not for you. And even with the gestures, there's conflicts of, like, you know, just Fruit Ninja or whatever that game was, fighting with the multitasking gestures of the five-finger swipe to go back to Springboard and all that other stuff. I'm not sure how long they can keep that up. Obviously, it's probably still absolutely the right thing to do on the phone and maybe even on smaller iPads, but as iPads become bigger and more capable, there's a war for the pixels on the screen on the iPad, and I think the OS has to win at least a pixel or two. Just two secret pixels up in the left-hand corner that if you can find a way to tap them with your fatty meat fingers, congratulations, you get an Apple menu or some kind of toolbar or popover or whatever. Because I don't think gestures are great, but they're totally non-discoverable. They're easy to do accidentally. And when it comes to complex applications that people use that have lots of functionality, it's hard enough to get that functionality into the app. And then to say, oh, by the way, the OS has a bunch of features too. Where do those get to go? It's like, those can only be invisible. Sorry. I don't think that's sustainable long term.
They just need a little pie icon in the bottom right. That'll solve
it. They can't. Those pixels are owned by the app. Sorry.
I get the reference.
I get it.
Oh, thanks, Marco.
Come on. We all get the reference. You know,
sure, when you do.
When Casey makes a reference and we all don't say, that's from the net, doesn't mean we don't know it. It just means that we're all happy and proud of Casey for making a reference, and we're all smiling knowingly. Like when you did that, what did you do? The song reference the other day that Marco and I got, but we had to hear everybody tell us that we didn't get it. Although I admit I was surprised that Marco got it.
Yes, what was that?
It was the black curtains in the white room. And
that's right. Cream. Yes. Did you know The Net was filmed in San Francisco's Moscone Center and Macworld on January 5th, 1995?
I didn't know that. Escape the system.
Just think, their crew might have eaten the same box lunches that we ate.
Literally the same. They've just been sitting there since then.
Yeah, seriously, since 95.
All right, thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace, Jamf Now, and Linode. And we will talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
Oh, God. I finally finished watching Heat, and I did it off of your Plex, Casey. I mean, I bought it, of course,
yeah.
But I also watched it off of your Plex because the version I bought looked too good, and so I wanted a crappier version, so I streamed it off your Plex, and... Ooh.
I think that was a direct Blu-ray rip that I did myself. Why? What was wrong?
Streaming it off your Plex was challenging.
Really? That shouldn't have been.
I watched it over the course of two nights. And in both cases, Plex had a very hard time streaming it consistently until I dropped the bandwidth down to 0.7 megabits, at which point that finally streamed reliably
that
and looked horrible.
That is insane.
Yeah.
Really?
It was. That being said, it matched my opinion of the movie as well, so it was fine, but...
I can already tell. I'm dread this top four episode because I don't agree with any of your tastes in movies.
Yeah, this episode of Top Four might be the new... You know what we should do, John, is we should rank the top four episodes of Top Four. No, that have the worst conclusions. That's what we need to do.
Do any of them have conclusions? That's...
Well,
whoever's maintaining the top four wiki has their work cut out for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, we're going to record the top four pretty soon. I will just say that I don't know why Heat is on so many lists of top heist movies, because while I could appreciate parts of it as a decent movie, it is in no way a heist movie. And so it should not be on those lists. And that's all I'll say for now. I will save the rest for top four.
Marco, I can't do this with you.
Whenever
right
they
now.
Do categories on top four, it ends up being all about what is best fit for the category, and they set aside like what is actually a good movie. So like, I'm sure whatever they pick as their best heist movie is not going to be the best movie on the list.
It's not. No. It's
part
not
of the format.
It's not that we set aside like that
you,
the quality
you
movie.
Very
completely.
Much set aside.
It's that. It's that how much it adheres to the quality we picked is a factor. Like it's a weight on its score.
It's a big, often it is a very big factor.
Yes. Well, because if we say top heist movies and then two of the movies on the list are really barely or not really heist movies.
Well, I mean, I guess it just comes back to what I said before and how my taste in movies differs. So I often can't stomach the idea that you would, yeah. that because it fits with a heist movie and you like it, but I think it's like the worst movie on the list, and like I don't care how much of it. Anyway, we'll see. We'll see what you guys end up picking.